Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yakir Englander. Today, we'll be talking to Schneer Zalman Neufeld, the author of Degrees of Separation. In the past months, many of us were introduced to the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in the U.S. by the Netflix show Unorthodox. Some of us also watched the painful documentary One of Us on Netflix too. The ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, and mostly the Hasidic community, which is one of the two main streams in ultra-Orthodox Jewish world, is an example of a community who decided to exist in the midst of Western secular society, but to lead a very different way of life. The community focuses on the questions of why we are alive, and what is the mission that humans, and more specifically Jews, has to fulfill in this life. The days of the community members are dedicated to study of the Jewish holy text, to charity and prayers. One of the unique elements in this community is that each and every act in life, from praying to cooking, putting clothes on, making love, or going to the bathroom, should be dedicated to their spiritual growth, and they doing it by having clear and exact ways how to do these actions according to the Jewish law, the halakha. Naturally, this unique way of living fit many of its members, but not all of them. Many of those who do not fit and sometimes even suffer will stay in the community and will lead their lives with compromises and even by lying to themselves and to the community. A few of them will have the courage to leave the community and to pay the price of their decision. In the next years after their decision to leave the community, they will be constantly running between narratives, between wishing to fit in Western society and knowing that probably it will never happen, since their past is part of who they are. I wonder if any of them will ever find peace in their hearts. Today we're hosting Dr. Schneer Zalman Neufeld to talk and learn about his book, Degrees of Separation, Identity Formation While Living Ultra-Orthodox Judaism, published at Temple University Press in 2020. Dr. Neufeld is an assistant professor of sociology in the Department of Social Sciences, Human Services and Criminal Justice in the Borough of Manhattan Community College, City University of New York. So, Schneer Zalman, welcome to our show. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to decide to write this incredible book?
Sure. So, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And To get into your question, so for me, because my book is about people who grew up in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community and then left, there's an obvious connection with my own life story. I grew up Lubavitch in the Hasidic community in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And in my early 20s, I began to sort of move away from that community. Then in part related to my process of going to college, And then essentially by the time I left college in my mid-20s, I was already very much on the outside of the community in a lot of important ways. And then shortly after graduating from Brooklyn College with my BA in psychology, I enrolled in the PhD program in sociology at NYU. And I knew from the outset that I wanted to study people like myself who grew up in the ultra-Orthodox community and then left. So that's really what I began to study. And what I found was that the literature on people leaving religions, the scholars tended to assume a binary form of religious identification. So essentially, they tended to assume that either people were a part of their community that they grew up in, or they left and they were completely disconnected from it. And I knew that this did not correspond with my own experience. So I started to do interviews. I interviewed eventually 74 men and women from two Hasidic sects, two communities, the Lubavitch and Satmar communities. And I found that what the many scholars, especially in sociology that I was looking at, that were talking about these issues, that what they were describing did not correspond with what my people I was interviewing had experienced either. So this is really what led me to write the book and to focus on this issue of the what some scholars refer to as the residual effects, the aspects of people's identity that stay with them even after they go through major life transformations. And that's really why I gave my book the title Degrees of Separation, to highlight this point that even though people were leaving their community and in many ways changing really significant things about their upbringing, such as their dress, what they wore, the kinds of foods that they ate, did they keep the laws of the kosher restrictions or not, much of what they thought, what they believed, how they practiced their life. But still, there were these residual effects, these things that stayed with people even after they left. So again, there's degrees of separation. They're separated from their community, but not completely disconnected. They're still connected in significant ways. And that's what led me to, again, to write the book and to focus on these issues.
Thank you so much. So I wonder if you can elaborate for us a little bit more, because when we read the book and we think about this phenomena, and later we will speak even about the terms, this very people with a lot of they need a lot of courage, right? And they leave the family, they leave the community, they leave God, they leave their religion. Do you find by the interviews that they know what do they want to leave?
Right. So this is exactly a big part of, I'm sort of chuckling, because this is a big part of the issue, right? So I think your question is really so on target, because essentially there's an assumption, right, both in popular culture, but even I think among some scholars, that tends to assume that the process is a highly organized and pre-planned sort of thing, where people know what the destination is before they get there. And I think that that's really not the way that people in general experience their life, including people who are going through major life transformations, such as leaving a form of religion. I think that there's a line. Now I'm trying to remember the line. From Darkness at Noon, where he talks about how he only became a heretic. He only sort of left the doctrines of the Communist Party. He only realized later that he had already done it. that it was something that sort of snuck up on him, that he didn't realize that it was becoming a counter-revolutionary or whatever, you know? And I think that that's really, it's interesting. It's not, in a sense, sort of explicitly central to my book, but I think undergirding all of it is really this kind of, the sense that people don't know or don't plan their personal transformations in this kind of linear and logical way. That people go through life, they have experiences, they're exposed to different influences, and then they respond to those and they calibrate their own thinking, their own behavior accordingly, and then gradually they sort of end up in a different place than than they started out, and maybe even a different place than they had intended. And I could speak on a personal note. I remember very distinctly early on in my career at Brooklyn College, I was standing in the bookstore at Brooklyn College, and a dear friend of mine from childhood, who also grew up Lubavitch, came in, and I was sort of shocked that he was there. And then it turned out we had both enrolled in Brooklyn College, and we started speaking, and we both had beards that were required by the Lubavitch community. And as we were talking, he made a comment like, "You'll see, by the end of college, your beard will be gone." And I said, "Chas v'shalom, God forbid! What are you talking about? This is not my plan. I'm not here to, quote unquote, go fry, to leave the Orthodox community. I'm here to become educated, whatever." And lo and behold, he was right. Very shortly before I graduated college, I had shaved my beard. And, you know, of course, someone could say that I was just being, and I was in denial. I was just trying to hide it from myself, that, you know, this was really the path that I was on. But I think the deeper truth is that people are not aware of the exact direction that they're headed. I knew that I wanted something different than I had growing up in Lubavitch. I knew I wanted an education. I knew I was interested in intellectual thought. I was interested in understanding what other people are thinking about, what's going on in other cultures, other religions. But I didn't know or didn't think, well, this is exactly where I'm going to end up. And I don't think that I'm unique, that this experience is unique to me. I think that this is actually much more common than is commonly assumed or even assumed among scholars, that people's lives take shape based on all sorts of contingent factors, and that it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to plot the trajectory of anyone's life in advance.
And is it true also when people coming from secular life to religious life, or when we look on what we call chozrim b'tshuva, people who become religious, they know more just because they have institute that most of the time, you know, they join to them, like the synagogue, the other religious institute like the yeshiva. And I even think about the terms, right? So the terms are very interesting. And you can please teach us about the American terms. But in Hebrew, when someone come from secular life to religious life, we call them chozer b'tshuva, someone who return with an answer, which means that we are focusing on what we know with the answer, right? But when someone leave, we don't call them coming back, return. We call them yotzim. You go out, right? You leave b'she'ela, with a question, which is exactly what you speak about, like the unknown. You have a question, but you really don't walk with answers.
So it's interesting because I interpret the terms slightly differently than what you described. And I think it relates to what we're talking about, that even the term yotzim b'she'ela, it's to my ears, it implies that the reason why people left is because they had questions. In other words, I would say that term itself is problematic because it privileges intellectual reasons for leaving. And I think that this is one of the ways that you see what we're talking about play out in my book, because in my book, I have a whole chapter on the kind of internal debate among people who leave over the reasons for leaving. And essentially, there's two camps within this debate. On the one hand, you have what I call the intellectual camp, the people who claim that the reason why they're leaving their community is for intellectual reasons. They either have found flaws in the Bible, flaws in the Talmud, they found contradictions between these holy texts and scientific realities, evolution, or what have you, you know? Or, and then on the other side is a kind of emotional social group, the people who frame their exiting as based on social things that happen to them, often traumatic things, sexual abuse, issues of sexual identity, or the oppression of sexual minorities within these communities, and things like that. So I would argue that that the truth is that these are narratives that people who leave construct. So they develop these narratives that prioritize or make central some aspect of their story. Again, either the intellectual argumentation that they were struggling with or the social kind of lived experience that they had in their community. But in fact, people are not just a heart or a mind. People have a heart, they have a mind, they have a body. All of these things are working simultaneously if in complex ways. So I think that people in reality leave both for intellectual reasons and for social or emotional reasons. But again, within the population of people that leave, there's often the sense that you have to pick one, you have to choose. You're either on team A or team B. And I think, again,
can you say why?
Sure. But just before that,
please,
to tie it back into this thing, yes, about the labels, the label Chozim B'Sheila, I would say that's
your team, leaving with,
yes, I'm sorry, your team B'Sheila, people who are leaving, quote unquote, with a question, or for a question, I would argue that that term itself kind of privileges the intellectual camp or the intellectual narrative for leaving. So why do they do this? I talk about this in the book, and I think, you know, it's a interesting question why you have these divisions. I think for one thing, it's interesting, there's many divisions within the population of people leaving the ultra-Orthodox community. One division is what we're talking about now, people arguing over the legitimate, quote unquote, reason for leaving. There's also divisions sort of along sectarian lines, as it were. So people argue about who has a harder time leaving the community. Is it the Satmar exiters? Is it the Lubavitch exiters? Is it some other group?
Which, just for the listeners, it's, yeah, two sects inside the Hasidic ultra-Orthodox community.
Exactly. And like many names for Hasidic communities, both Satmar and Lubavitch refer back to towns or cities in Eastern Europe where this particular Hasidic sect originated. So now they exist in many places in the world, but they're both headquartered largely in New York, in Brooklyn. The Satmar community actually has two headquarters, one in Brooklyn in Williamsburg, the other one in Monroe County. And the Lubavitch community is headquartered in Crown Heights in Brooklyn. So there's arguments among people from these various sects and say who has it the hardest, whatever. There's arguments between men and women. Do men have it harder? Do women have it harder? Do people who are Balei Tshuva that you mentioned before, people who join the Hasidic community from the outside world, but then some of them end up deciding that they also want to leave and go back to the sort of mainstream culture, you know, are they particularly advantaged or disadvantaged? So I'm saying that there's many struggles going on.
But my question is, Shneur Zalman, why do you think that people create these narratives and this competition? I mean, it's so hard anyway. So is it like a competition about who has a harder time? Because it sounds for me that we speak here about like who has a better narrative in a way, and it's all constructed narrative. So I wonder why.
Sure. So I think, yes, there is a kind of competition where the one who suffered the most is the winner. That's the way the game is set. And I think that one reason for this type of competition is sort of a Freudian take, you could say, is looking at the narcissist of small difference. You know, that there's so much similarity between people within this group, right? They all came from relatively similar communities. They all went through many struggles, many difficulties, many challenges, you know, and they're all trying to make it in the outside world. So in so many ways, there's a kind of a aspect of uniformity that they share in common. And I think in a sense, it's almost because of that, the pressure of uniformity, where people feel a kind of a basic desire to differentiate themselves and say, look, I'm not like everyone else. You know, sure, there's a lot of things we have in common, but there's something really important that we have that's different. And not only that, but within this particular realm, I actually had it harder, and therefore I win. And I think, again, often people who are going through this process often end up socializing together. So there's a lot of time, there's ample opportunity for people to compete in this particular Olympics, where they're constantly struggling to find some difference that they could focus on. And I also think that in a sense, it's an example of a residual effect. It's something that they kind of carry over from their upbringing, where within the communities that they were raised in, there's so many sectarian struggles going on. So there's sectarian strife between the Lubavitch and Satmar community going back to the 1980s. There's struggles between all the Hasidic communities and the non-Hasidic, but still ultra-Orthodox groups, that this struggle is going back for 300 years over the legitimacy of the Hasidic movement itself. So there's many, many struggles within the ultra-Orthodox world, divisions and subdivisions, and it's a very common feature. And I talk about this in the book in the introduction to kind of set the stage. There's a lot of these divisions and subdivisions. And again, even though to outsiders, even Jewish, you know, outsiders, so less observant Jews, they might look at a Satmar person and call them a Lubavitcher, or vice versa. I often have friends or people that see me, they hear about my background, and they say, oh, I saw a Lubavitcher on TV. Well, then it turns out it was actually a Satmar person. Well, to me, this is a world of difference. To them, they say, well, they all look alike. I mean, aren't they the same, you know? But of course, within these communities, these differences are very salient. So I would argue that in a way, this type of internal struggle, finding differences and focusing on those differences is actually a feature of the ultra-Orthodox community, and very possibly some of the people who leave that community still maintain this desire to find internal differences and kind of focus on them. And I think that that's another possible reason why we see these kinds of struggles over what is who suffered the most, or what is the legitimate reason for leaving. And a third thing is that I think, again, because the process of leaving is so so difficult, and for many people so traumatic, and at the same time, for a lot of people, it is very much grounded in intellectual argumentation. And they want to know, you know, who wrote the Bible? Is the Bible, quote unquote, legitimate? What are legitimate forms of argumentation that you can make within the study of the Bible or the Talmud? are there scientific forms of analysis that are quote unquote legitimate to help illuminate these ancient texts or what have you? So I think the issue of legitimacy, and especially the issue of legitimacy in terms of argumentation, is so central to the process of leaving itself that I think it's not surprising that within the community of people leaving, they are very attuned to this issue of legitimacy. And as soon as someone starts to develop a narrative about their reason for leaving, people immediately say, wait a minute, is that a legitimate narrative? Is that a legitimate argument for leaving or not? So I think it's, in a sense, a kind of natural outgrowth of the focus among many people in the process of leaving, the focus on argumentation and legitimacy.
Do they have inside the community of people who leave the rabbi who decide who is legitimate?
I'm sorry, say again?
Do they have inside the community of people who decide to leave the ultra-Orthodox community kind of the rabbis, and I with quotation, like the people who tell the truth, like who is the real person who left the community and who is like more leaving the community and who is less?
Right. No, I understand what you're saying. That's a good question. Are there authority figures within the Exeter community? And I think that
I'm thinking about even about, because it's connected also to technical things. So I don't know about the American, but I know in the Israeli narrative, the Israeli story, there are two or three organizations who really support the people who leave the ultra-Orthodox community. But then there are the question, who is inside, to whom we support, because the money and the financial support is very limited. So they need to decide to whom we support and who we say, you know what, this is, you didn't really left the ultra-Orthodox. You left only the modern Orthodox or things like that, and who we really support. Like, for example, in Israel, so we have people who didn't grow up at all with Hebrew. I wonder if it's like, if you have English, so you have a little bit more capital that you can, you know, engage with. If you don't have it, I think about in Israel, women, they study secular studies. So when they leave, at least they have, you know, the high school degree. The boys do not have it. So I wonder if you saw these differences also here.
Right. So definitely some of the arguments that I was talking about before in terms of who has it worse, you know, when they were inside or their process of leaving, some of it very much maps along the lines that you're indicating. So, for instance, people who are leaving only modern Orthodox, right, communities. So they presumably got a decent secular education, right? So it's clear that someone could say that they had an easier time integrating into the larger society because they already spoke the language and, you know, learned at least the rudiments of math and science and so on. Whereas Hasidic people who tend not to get very much, if any, of the secular education, they're lacking that familiarity to start off with. And then also women, yes, in America as well, Hasidic women tend to get much more secular education than Hasidic men. So these kinds of things exist here. And again, people certainly refer to them. But in terms of sort of authority figures within the Exeter community, there certainly are some famous people who have written memoirs, for instance, of their experience. I think that those are probably some of the most kind of well-known figures within this population. But it's interesting. On the one hand, some people really look up to them and they say, oh, you know, those are models to emulate, or those are certainly people to really respect. Look how far they came. They wrote a memoir. They were so successful, you know. And at the same time, for all sorts of psychological reasons, some people look at them as especially appropriate targets for abuse. You know, who do those people think they are? Do you think that they're really smarter than me or my friend sitting next to me? Do you think that they really understand the real questions? Did they get the real problems with the community, or did they only get the superficial? official parts, you know, so you have that going on. And the same thing in America, we also have organization Footsteps, which is a New York-based NGO, and that tries to help people who are leaving the Orthodox community. And again, many people in this population are connected to the organization and really appreciate it. Some of them feel that this organization maybe even, you know, helped save their life, that they were in a very difficult situation and they provided necessary support and services. At the same time, other people feel like either the organization doesn't go nearly far enough, or the organization is wrong-headed and they're not focusing on the important things. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we have to realize that we're talking about a population of people who are rebels. Like, by definition, they rebelled against the system that they grew up in. So it's not surprising that at least some of them are cantankerous, because, you know, these are people who by definition are very attuned to inconsistencies in institutions or leadership figures. So they're especially prone to finding things that are not perfect about either individual kind of figures who leave the community, or even among organizations that are trying to help this population.
Which is interesting, right? That in a way, because the ultra-Orthodox narrative speaks about perfection, it's like you have the rabbi who is a perfect figure, and you have the Torah, which is the truth. And there is probably, I guess, a desire, even when you leave, that you will find perfection now in the secular world. And maybe this is something that holds you, because I think that one of the things that we see in Western secular society, like among people who grew up in this generation, is a walking without knowing. It's like the skeptic, right? And here you have the rebel, but the rebel come because the rebel wants more truth. Like, they feel that something is not right, right? So it's so interesting what you bring.
Yeah. If I could just comment.
Please, of course.
I think that one of the things that's really interesting about this topic, and again, I don't focus on this in this book, but it's something that's really worth thinking about, is sort of, because again, this book is focusing on the process of leaving and sort of where people end up religiously and in terms of their relationship to their family after they leave. That's really kind of the focus here. But one thing that's really interesting to look at is how people respond to the outside, quote unquote, secular world. And I think that at least sometimes you hear that people who leave the ultra-Orthodox community, even though maybe they're happy that they left, at the same time, there are disappointments. And I think that part of it gets to what you were just describing, that people, when they before they leave, they're very aware of the shortcomings of their community of origin, maybe their family of origin, their neighbors, the spiritual or religious leaders of their community, you know, and they tend to develop a kind of utopian view of the outside world, where essentially they blame all of the problems or the difficulties of their life, let's say, abuse that they experienced. They tend to ascribe that to the religious doctrines or rituals or communal infrastructure of their community. And they basically feel, well, of course, this would never happen in the outside world. And for instance, one thing that Footsteps as an organization tried to look into a little bit was the issue of sexual abuse. So we know that some of the people who leave these communities experience horrific sexual abuse in the community. So it's not surprising that they might develop a narrative that says, well, these things happen in the Hasidic community because sexuality itself is such a taboo and people don't talk about it and people don't get sex education. So they're unaware of when they're being abused, or even if they are aware, there aren't the properly developed channels to report this abuse and stop it and so on, prevent it. But then when they leave the community, they find that people are also abused sexually in the outside world. And this could be a very disheartening realization. And then essentially people have to go through a process of recalibration to understand, well, you know, even though there are these negative things in the outside secular world, I'm still glad that I left, but I really have to, you know, make certain adjustments in my thinking and my behavior in order to confront the realities, the negative realities that still exist in the outside world.
Thank you. Can you say a little bit about, can we find difference between ultra-Orthodox who left before the virtual and the internet become more accessible, and people who left before? I just wonder, because people who left before, they didn't know where do they go. People who are living now, at least for some of them, probably the first steps is to still be inside the community, but to start using the internet, to start learning. I mean, today you mentioned the organization that helps. So we have on Netflix, One of Us as an incredible documentary about the phenomena. And we have also Unorthodox, which is a series after the book of Deborah Feldman. And I wonder, which means that even the non-ultra-Orthodox world is more, they can learn more about this unique community. But it's also true about the other side. I mean, you can find other people who left the community. And I wonder if you found in your research a difference between people who left 10 years ago, maybe, when it was less popular, the internet, less accessible than today.
Right. So it's a really good question. For my study, it tended to focus on the research was conducted about 7-8 years ago. So it was during one period, and I tended to focus on people in their early 20s to early 30s. So we really have one cohort. There were a few people in the study that were older, but it's hard to draw too many conclusions from such a small sample. But I definitely think that the internet plays a role or could play a role in the process of leaving. And certainly people could find information, as you were saying, make social contacts, you know, through the internet. At the same time, I think that, and that's, you know, that could be great. But at the same time, I think that so much of what is traumatic about the process of leaving has to do with things that go so deep that a simple Google search, you know, is very hard to uncover. So people may know a lot of information. I mean, even think about a simple thing, so to speak, like college, right? People are thinking about attending college. So they could Google, they could find out, you know, all sorts of basic information, how much it costs, what exams you have to take in order to get into the college or what have you. But it's very hard to know what the experience of going to college is like, especially for someone who left the ultra-Orthodox community and came from ultra-Orthodox world and has an ultra-Orthodox world view. I think it's very hard to really get at those kinds of issues, even with the aid of a smartphone, which is, as you know, forbidden within many of these communities, specifically because they're concerned that it allows people to be exposed to all sorts of outside influences that they're trying to keep at bay. But I think the point is that it does help in some ways, but I think a lot of the trauma and the challenges of leaving the ultra-Orthodox community are still, and the absence of certain kinds of information, I think, is still very much present, even with in the age of the digital age and the information superhighway.
I wonder, when people think about leaving the community, the ultra-Orthodox community, we think about people who wish to be secular, or they want to leave the religion. I wonder if we have other cases which are the opposite. I met some of them in Israel, people who left the community because they wanted to be closer, not to the ultra-Orthodox community, but they wanted to be closer to the divine. That they felt that the tools that they got inside the community do not give them the best ways, or they give them maybe in an incredible one way, but they feel that they need to find other ways. And then you meet them in interface dialogue places. You meet them finding the divine by in secular, by art or music. Do we have them? Did you find?
So I hear what you're saying, and I think that it's certainly possible that we have people that would frame their leaving in that way. I can't think of a particular person I interviewed that described it like that, but I would say that some of the people, not all, but some of the people that leave are the most, or were the most sincere people in their community of origin. In other words, even though, again, within these communities of religious communities, ultra-Orthodox communities, the assumption is that people who leave are bums. They're the lowlifes. They're the riffraff. They're people who were never serious about studying or never serious about piety. But the truth is that some of the people that leave are the exact opposite. They were the most sincere. They were the Rebbe's favorite students. They were the most pious. I mean, I spoke to some people who were taking on fasting in the community on their own, kind of private fasting in order to reach higher spiritual heights. People who were so punctilious with the mitzvot, with the religious commandments, that they were made fun of by other people in the ultra-Orthodox community, and basically were told, "Hey, you're a fanatic. What are you trying to do? You think we're in a cult? You think we're crazy here? I mean, this is Lubavitch. This is Satmar. We're not crazy. We're not going to do the kind of stuff you're doing." You know, so people that were truly, truly committed to the principles of the community, and it's because they either found that the other people around them were not nearly as serious as they were, or they found some kind of intellectual or emotional disconnect with the community that caused them to leave. But in other words, they didn't leave because they, quote unquote, wanted to have a good time. They left because they felt disenchanted by the piety or the pursuit of piety within these communities. So in other words, they left because they felt that these communities failed on the precise yardstick that the community holds up as being so important, as being the thing, the avenue to connect them to the divine. So definitely there's some people like that. Again, it's certainly not all of them, but some people are very much within this model.
Fascinating. So, Shneur Zalman, I want to bring here an old Jewish text, a story, because the Hasidim, the ultra-Orthodox, they love stories. So there is a story in the Talmud, in the tractate, which called Chagigah, about four top rabbis who decided to meet with a divine. One of them died, and I think about... Let's first tell the story. One of them died. The second became crazy. The third lost. He became the other. This is his nickname. And the fourth, he came in peace and left in peace. What is fascinating for me in this story, I mean, there are many elements, is that three of the four, we don't know their names. Because the first two, the one who died and the one who became crazy, we call them in the name of their parent. We don't call them in their name, right? And the third one who lost his identity, he became the real rebel against the divine, and he said that there is more than one, which is the same in Judaism. he's called the other. And I'm thinking about the incredible stories and narratives that you bring in your book. We have those who commit suicide. And this is a phenomena that we all aware, right? About people who commit suicide, which is part of their living. I mean, the living also seriously their body and soul, right? We have those who lost it, who became crazy in the meaning. It can be in different ways, right? It's like, or that they become very radical into drugs and other things that they try, or that they can be also crazy in the meaning that they never left, in the meaning that they keep dealing with the narrative of the living, right? They meet only with ultra-Orthodox who left like them, and they like struggle. And then there are the ones who, and then there is the two others, which are fascinating. One who come in peace and live with peace, which I wonder what changed in him. Maybe he was just really not ready to be ultra-Orthodox or something like that. And then you have the one who became an other, the other. And I wonder if you can take this story and tell us something about the narratives of living.
Yeah, so that's a wonderful story, and I've thought a lot about it. And it's interesting. One thing that jumps out at me, you mentioned a story from the Talmud. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the spiritual leader of the community that I left, he talked about this story, and he says he made an interesting observation. He says that Rabbi Akiva, the fourth one, the one who came in peace and went in peace, he says it's interesting that it says he came in peace and he went in peace. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe comments that you might think that those two things are incidental. It happens to be that he came in peace and it happens to be he went in peace. And he says that that's not the case, that there's a causal relationship. It's because he came in peace, he went to heaven, to this higher realm in a state of peace and preparedness, that he was able to then exit it and in a peaceful way, in a harmonious way. And I think that that is very relevant to what we're talking about, because as you are aware, there's a lot of politics around the narrative, around these stories. We talked before about the internal politics among the Exeter community, but there's also a struggle between the Exeter community and their community of origin over the issue of narrative, right? Why do people leave? Well, from the perspective of the community, people of the religious community, people leave because they're meshuga, they're crazy, they have a mental problem. In other words, there's something wrong with them, not with us. The community is sacred. The community is upstanding, is proper, is flawless, at least in principle. And anyone who leaves, it's the deficiency is in them. They're too lustful. They're not able to control their bodily desires, so therefore they leave. Or they're mentally deficient; they have a mental illness, and that's why they leave. You know, so there's this whole struggle going on. And then, from the perspective of the people who leave, they certainly reject this narrative from their community of origin. So the point is that, and especially the issue of mental illness, comes up within this struggle over narrative. And of course, in a population, we're not clear, we don't know exactly how many people leave the ultra-Orthodox community. We don't have great quantitative studies on it, but one study estimates that there's 10,000 people worldwide who leave the ultra-Orthodox community. Another study puts the number higher. Assuming the 10,000 figure, any group of people that has 10,000 souls, there's going to be some people that have a mental illness. So the real question is not, do any Exeters have a mental illness? The real question is, do all the Exeters have a mental illness? And secondly, is the reason why they leave due to the mental illness? So even if you look at an individual, a person who may have a mental illness, or a subdivision of the total population of Exeters who have mental illnesses, is the reason why they leave due to that mental illness? In the same way that I interviewed one person who was sexually abused. He told me he was sexually abused in the community. The interesting thing is that from the perspective of his family and others in the community, they argued that the reason why he left is because of the sexual abuse. Whereas according to the person I interviewed, he said, yes, I was sexually abused. It was a very traumatic thing. But that's not the main reason or even one of the really important reasons for why I left. There's all sorts of things that were going on in my life. It happens to be that I was sexually abused. So there's a big issue about how do you you frame the narrative, the reason for leaving. So to go back to Rabbi Akiva, this ancient rabbi who went in peace and returned in peace from the higher realm that the Talmud discusses. The point is that some people who leave the Hasidic community, they were doing very well in the community. They were healthy in terms of their mental health, and then when they leave the community, they're also they don't have struggles with mental illness. Other people might have challenges within the community, and when they leave, they may continue to have challenges. But again, the way that the Hasidic community frames it is, well, the reason that they left is because of the mental illness, rather than saying there could be any number of reasons why the person left. It just happens to be that they also have a mental illness. So I think that the way that these narratives are framed is really important, and there's a big struggle between these community of origin, the community of origins of origin, and the people who are leaving them over how to frame the issue.
Which I can totally understand why for the community is very important, because if it's about mental issues, so in their narrative, it means that they didn't do anything wrong, right? And therefore, if you just raise a proper, in a proper way, everything will be okay. But I guess that there are other voices who understand that it's more complicated. And I think about that because one of the fascinating things in your book is about the relationship between the people who left and the people who and their families. And one thing that surprised me, because maybe in Israel it's a bit different, is that many times in Israel, at least for a few years, there is a totally disconnection from the family towards the person who, for the child who left the community. And it sounds that here it's more gentle. There is a gentler dance. And then I wonder about like the narratives inside the family, because even if the community said that this child who left or this husband or wife who left, they have mental challenges, for the family, it's probably a different narrative because it's a family member.
Right. So I did notice that within the scholarship that talks about people leaving in the Israeli context, it does seem like the communal response is harsher than it is in Israel. And you could think about something about the Israeli culture, and there might be a more sort of intense piety within the Israeli context compared to the American context. There does seem to be a sort of regional differences. At the same time, even within the American context, in the book, I talk about how the Lubavitch community, or the Satmar community rather, responds much more harshly to people leaving than the Lubavitch community. So even within the American context, we see variation in terms of just how repressive or harsh the response is. But among both communities that I look at, in general, people after they leave, even though initially when they leave, there could be a kind of break with their family, but after a period, sort of like a cooling off period, they tend to build bridges and find some way to reconnect and to maintain family relations. Again, to go back to Rabbi Akiva, it depends what the status of the family relations or the family dynamic was pre-exit. That has a big influence on the kind of family dynamic post-exit. So right. Some of the people that I interviewed came from profoundly destabilized and dysfunctional families where there really was abuse or neglect. And in those contexts, it's not surprising that people are really not eager to reconnect with their family, or sometimes they really refuse, even when the family wanted to reconnect with them, they simply refused. They said, no, these people are toxic and I don't want to be in a relationship with them. Whereas other people who left, who really had a loving relationship with their family before they left, were often eager to reconnect with their family. So even though there was this period of cooling off, sometimes for several months, sometimes even for several years, but once this period was ended, we see that they tend to reconnect with their family. Again, there's a spectrum in terms of what that family dynamic looks like.
Right, right.
Some people, it's just calling their family a few times a year, maybe before major Jewish holidays to wish them, happy holidays. In some cases, people would visit their family a few times a year, again, often related to Jewish holidays, but these tended to be short visits, sort of awkward encounters, somewhat cold or the reception. And in other cases, many other cases, there seemed to be genuine, closeness between the family and the person that left. And people might people might be really a part of their family's life, and they go to family celebrations, weddings, bar mitzvahs, and so on. They go to visit sort of on a regular Sunday. So there was a spectrum, but the main point is that there seemed to be a real effort on the part of the exiters as well as on the part of their families to try to reconnect and to try to have some kind of relationship, notwithstanding the vast religious and cultural differences between them.
Thank you. So Shneur Zalman, final question. And it's about the body. A person decides to leave the community. And my question is, can you tell us a little bit about the narratives of the bodies? And I will say when I grew up in the ultra-Orthodox community, one of our rabbis, he said, I cannot promise that you will not sin. I can promise that you will not enjoy from that. Because something in the body is so trained in a way that even when you do a sin, something there, probably because of the narrative and the way of growth and the trauma and the body, so how the body perceives the world, it takes the body to a long journey to live. Can you tell us a little bit about the journey of the body in living?
Sure. The first thing I have to say is that within Lubavitch, there's a famous saying, anyone who eats the kasha, the schwarze kasha, the black kasha, that they had in the yeshiva in Lubavitch in Eastern Europe, by that they meant anyone who was sort of a part of the yeshiva, will never enjoy this world again. So similar to what you were saying, you might indulge, but you won't enjoy. And so they have this kind of idea, and it's certainly true that it takes a very long time for the body to learn even the things that the mind has already learned, in terms of the exiting process. So in the book, again, I focus on these residual effects. I look at both intellectual issues, things about people's attitudes and beliefs that stay with them from their community of origin, as well as behavioral things and bodily things that sort of stay with people. To take one example of the body, how this plays out.
It's the fact that we both of us speak with the hands all the time here in the...
That the listeners can't see that, but that's
right.
That definitely... plus, in the book, I also talk about shuckling, about swaying. So a bunch of the people I spoke to, especially men, told me that growing up, they spent so much time in the yeshiva study halls, sitting, reading the Talmud, and constantly swaying when they were reading it. And then they found, even when they left, even when they went to, you know, major universities, and they were studying secular things, when they were sitting in the library reading their books, they found, they caught themselves shuckling, that they were still swaying over the text. But instead of a Talmud, it was a book of French philosophy. So yes, that's a kind of bodily ritual or bodily behavior, mannerism that stayed with them from their upbringing. But the thing that I was thinking of, which I talk about in the book, has to do with their relationship to pork. So when I interviewed the people in the book and I asked them, do they believe that God wrote the Torah? They said, oh, absolutely not. Well, do you believe that God exists? Well, maybe, maybe not. There's a diversity of opinions. Then I would say, well, do you keep kosher? Oh, absolutely not. We do not follow the strict kosher laws that we grew up with. I would say, okay, well, do you eat chazer? Do you eat pork? Do you eat pig? And suddenly, not everyone, but a lot of people said, no. No, that we don't do. We do a lot of things, but we don't do that. And I asked them, well why not? I mean, you know, if you don't follow the kosher dietary laws, what's holding you back from eating pork? And I remember one Lubavitch woman told me, well, I don't eat pork because pork is disgusting. And I said, pork is disgusting. I mean, millions of people, I don't know, billions of people around the world seem to enjoy it. What do you mean it's disgusting? And she said, no, you don't understand. I'm not saying that it taste-wise is disgusting. I'm saying personality-wise, pigs are disgusting, you know? And then I realized that there was a kind of indoctrination that these people went through in their community where they were told that pigs are disgusting. Pigs are a disgusting animal. Pigs are not kosher. They're dirty. They're unclean. And therefore, we don't eat them. And for a lot of the people, these people, even when they left, even when they changed so many things about their lifestyle, there was a kind of psychosomatic effect on their body that they simply couldn't tolerate pig. In fact, one woman told me that she once ate pig by accident, even though she left the community, she was not Orthodox in her mind at all, and she ate little tiny pieces of pig, and then she actually went to the bathroom in the restaurant and tried to make herself throw up because she was just so disgusted by the notion that she had consumed pig. And I think that this is an example of, even though intellectually she can't really make a coherent argument that there's something wrong with pig or that pig is actually more disgusting than cows or some other animal that she's used to eating. But the mere fact that she grew up, that her body was trained to not eat pig, suddenly it became very difficult, if not impossible, to turn that off. So I think there's a lot of ways in which people's bodies are much slower to respond to the changes that they're going through than their mind is.
Shneur Zalman Neufeld, thank you for writing Degrees of Separation. It was a pleasure to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.